Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The First Division, the Honorable Justice Michael B. Hyman presiding, case number 21-0856, Kimberly Nelson versus Retirement Board of Police Annuity and Benefit Fund, City of Chicago.
Thank you very much. I'm Justice Hyman. With me is Justice Amelia Buczynski and Justice Carl Walker. We're going to conduct this as if we were in the courtroom. Each side is 20 minutes. The appellant, you can reserve whatever time you wish for rebuttal. And we probably will interrupt you in the course of your argument. If we do, please finish your thought. And if you would go on to our question, that's the reason for oral arguments, is for our questions to be answered. So we each start with the appellants, introduce yourselves, and I see there's two appellant counsel. Are you going to split the argument, or is one of you going to argue?
Thank you. We're going to split 10 minutes and 10 minutes, if that's okay with the court.
That's fine. Do you want to reserve some time for a rebuttal?
That's good. Yes, I guess we would like to reserve five minutes for rebuttal. So that would mean I would go about 7 minutes at the beginning, and co-counsel would go about eight, and then I would do the rebuttal.
Okay. We don't stay real close to the clock. We don't have a minute hand, so don't worry if you're not on. You know, more important, you answer our questions. Appellee, please introduce yourself.
Appellee, Mitchell Klein for the appellee.
And attorney Brunel Donald Shea for the appellee as well.
Okay, now appellee.
Good morning, Sarah Bakeman on behalf of the Policeman's Annuity and Benefit.
And you have the rebuttal. I thought they were the appellee. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
So, go ahead. That's because how closely I read the name.
We don't mind, Your Honor. We don't mind having that rebuttal.
Take that back. No rebuttal. You get the rebuttal. Go ahead.
I would like to reserve probably 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Okay. I don't anticipate taking the full 20 minutes. I fully recognize that the court has read the briefs and understands the underlying issues here. So I have presented a few remarks, but I think it'll probably only be about 5 to 10 minutes. And then I'm happy to take any questions, of course, along the way. And I do want to apologize. I am 37 weeks pregnant. So if I seem short of breath at any time, I just want to apologize. Everything seems to be a little bit harder these days. And I am going to sit during the duration of my comments, if that's okay. I don't mean it as a sign of disrespect in any way, shape, or form, but it's a little easier.
One of the advantages of Zoom is most lawyers sit. So congratulations to you. And
thank
if you need a break or anything, don't worry. We're very easy on that. Whatever is comfortable for you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
If no one has any questions, please proceed.
Great. So like I said, it's an honor to be before you this afternoon. My name is Sarah Bakeman, and I represent the Policeman's Annuity and Benefit Fund in this matter. I am going to, like I said, just mention a few facts and arguments that I think are relevant to the issue before you today. But I do believe the majority of our points are outlined in the brief that we submitted before you. First, I want to highlight the fact that it's undisputed that Ms. Nelson is entitled to a duty disability benefit based on this court's prior April 24th, 2020 order. I also want to note that the board followed this court's order. So the court in that order specifically stated that Ms. Nelson was to be awarded a duty disability benefit, which occurred at a subsequent board hearing at its June 26, 2020 meeting.
Ms. Bakeman, I want to stop you right away and just ask you, because you all disagree on the standard of review here. And I'm just trying to see if at this point, if anyone has had any kind of enlightenment on that, and if that position has changed with either one of you, but you all are disagreeing.
We continue to assert that it's the manifest weight of the evidence, Your Honor. I think it's analogous to what the appellate court considered in the Samuels decision. And so when viewing the evidence under that standard, this court has a duty to uphold the board's decision in the event there's any evidence in the record that supports that decision. So I don't think our position on manifest weight of the evidence has not changed.
Your Honor, we believe there's a, I'm sorry.
No,
I'm sorry.
He'll ask you the question that, when it's your time.
Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
But I have a question for Ms. Oakman, if you don't mind. We've read the briefs in this case, the record in this case, the appellate court decision that was entered by Justice Mikva and her colleagues. I want to know if the board in the first trial before Justice Mikva's opinion, did you raise 154AI?
No, ma'am. Okay. The analysis was specific to whether or not Ms. Nelson was entitled to a duty disability benefit or an ordinary disability benefit.
Okay. And did you raise 154AI in the first court set of hearings before the first appeal? No.
No.
And
again, I apologize.
Okay.
Again, it was limited to whether or not she was entitled to a duty disability.
And you didn't raise 154AI in the first appeal before Justice Mikva either, right?
Correct.
Okay. But you have in this court, and in this appeal, you've raised it in the briefs. Did you raise it in the trial court?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So what happened procedurally is originally Ms. Nelson applied for a disability benefit. The board awarded her an ordinary disability benefit, finding that her disability at that time was not related to an active duty or in the performance of an active duty. That was affirmed by the trial court and then reversed by the appellate court in its April 24th, 2020 order. That decision was then remanded back to the board. The board awarded Ms. Nelson then, consistent with that order, a duty disability benefit, but then at that time analyzed what the benefit is she is entitled to under that duty disability section and concluded that she was entitled to that benefit at the 50% level, which is the citation that you just cited.
And that's because of for AI.
Mr. Clack, yeah, thank you. That'll help. Go ahead, Ms.
Beckman. And that decision was based on 154AI.
The board's decision at that
second round of hearings.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Great.
Coming back to that same question, Ms. Beckman, the appellate court in its previous decision, and that was a different panel of this court, none of these justices were on that panel, but that panel did address that issue, however, as to whether or not the benefits, whether or not the current condition was related to or connected to the prior psychological issues. Is that not correct?
I would argue that no. They analyzed under the ordinary disability statute and the duty disability statute whether or not the current injury or the current disability was caused in the performance of an active duty. And that's really the first prong of 154. And so what I would argue is the appellate court did analyze that first prong of 154 to determine, hey board, you got it wrong the first time. This isn't an ordinary, this is related to her performance in an active duty. But the General Assembly actually has it so that Article 5 is a little bit different than, for instance, firefighters, Article 6 of the Pension Code, insofar as after you make the determination that someone's entitled to a duty disability benefit, the analysis doesn't end there. Then you have to determine whether or not there's a pre-existing physical, mental, or disease condition in the record that stems to or aggravates, the case law talks about aggravates that pre-existing condition in such a way to qualify or spring into effect that disability that then qualifies that person for a 50% duty disability.
Right, in the prior decision, the other panel of this court addressed that in paragraph 43 of their decision. They also addressed it again later on in paragraph 44 and again, later in the decision as well, in paragraph 50. So, and I know you're probably not prepared to address all of those questions, but the board, the other division of this court, the other panel, I should say, clearly addressed the issue. And they made a finding that the current PTSD condition was not related to the other psychological issues. They actually made a finding that those issues had been resolved.
Well, I would just point out that the Samuels decision reviewed the exact same scenario. They said in that case, the underlying pre-existing condition has been resolved, that it didn't cause the disability. In fact, the officer was working during that entire period. It was only until that on-duty injury that the individual became disabled. And I would just note, you know, the appellate court is talking about causation here for purposes of determining what disability benefit is awarded, ordinary or duty. And the Samuels court, the appellate court in Samuels, said importantly, the term resulted from in that second prong analysis of 5154 does not imply causation, rather exasperation of a pre-existing condition. They specifically use that term that I noted, stems from. So while I recognize that those paragraphs cause pause, and I totally recognize that because they do talk about causation, the causation that the appellate court was reviewing, I believe, and what I've argued, is the causation about whether or not the injury is from an on-duty incident or it's unrelated to on-duty. And they determined that it was related to a duty incident and that a duty disability was appropriate.
Right, but Ms. Bakeman, you're speaking of the other case. I want to stick with this case because I'm concerned as to whether or not we're not dealing with a situation where we're talking about the law of the case.
Okay.
And whether this panel agrees or disagrees with the prior decision is not an issue. If it's the law of the case, we're bound by it. So, and that's what I want to kind of get to. And I know you didn't argue that in your brief and no one did, but I may as well throw it out there because I'm struggling with it.
Understood. And it gives me pause too. So I understand. I completely understand your point. I would argue, though, that I don't think they're inconsistent or mutually exclusive. So when you look, for instance, at the paragraph 43 that you cited of the appellate court's decision, I think the sentence that gives you pause and the one that gave me pause, moreover, the fact that Ms. Nelson may have been particularly susceptible to PTSD does not change the fact that the cause of her current condition was the events of December 8, 2016. So again, that's under the analysis of, does she receive a duty disability benefit or an ordinary? Once you've determined, which the appellate court has here, that she's entitled to that duty disability benefit based on that the current condition was the event of the December 8th, 2016, the analysis doesn't stop there. It did for the appellate court in this instance, because all they had in front of them is whether or not she was entitled to an ordinary disability benefit or a duty disability benefit.
Let me say, Ms. Bickman, I agree with you that the analysis does not stop there. And so you're 100% correct. But the problem that I'm having is, did the appellate court already conduct that further analysis? And I understand your argument is no, they didn't, because that was not an issue that was before them. But it seems as though they may have, and I think we've got to try to resolve that.
Understood. And I think the way that you resolve that is if you take what they've said in this and then apply it under that analysis, under the second prong of 154.
Well, now I have to look at paragraph 50 then. I agree with you again. But paragraph 50, the very bottom of paragraph 50, we have the same issue. Mm-hmm. They repeat it again.
But let me see if I can focus it a little bit.
Please, go ahead, Justice Simon.
Justice's question. In paragraph 53, at the end, they reverse the circuit court and decision the pension is set aside. So they don't say anything about being remanded. I mean, does that mean the case was ended? Apparently not, because there was a further proceedings, right? But I just want to point out that there was nothing in paragraph 54 that said that any other proceeding should proceed. Did that have any effect? How should we interpret that in your opinion?
I think that's a great question.
That is a great question. I will note that practically, I mean, what happened is it was remanded back to the circuit court, which then, you know, asked the board to, it remanded it to the board to issue a finding.
We didn't say that panel did not say remand. Usually, right. I fairly have seen a case where if we say you're done. If we see a remand, it's not done. And if it's unclear, we would be, every case would go back, you know, if we didn't say the word, only when it's remand does it go back. Otherwise, the case is over. I mean, that's one view. I'm just saying, in this circumstance, is maybe there's something I'm missing. I'm just trying to look at that.
Right. Although I think the devil's advocate argument on that would be then, shouldn't they have said, if Justice Walker is correct and they've reviewed this, or his point is taken to its conclusion, that they reviewed the issue of what benefit she's entitled to under 154, not just that she's entitled to a duty disability, but that she's entitled to the full 75%. Wouldn't they have said that when they said, for the reasons stated above, we set aside the board's decision in order that Ms. Nelson be awarded a duty disability benefit at 75% of her salary?
Well, the reason, go ahead, Justice Hyman. I'll let you respond.
Go ahead. It was your original question. So
the reason why it wasn't necessary is because if you go back to their analysis, as they speak about the two different possibilities, they only give you two possibilities, and that is either she's going to be awarded 50% ordinary disability, or she's going to be awarded duty disability, and which is at 75%. And that's in paragraphs 36 and 37
right, of
the order. And so they end by simply saying that she's awarded duty benefits, which implies that she's awarded the 75%. Now, I agree with you that they should have said it, but I still think Justice Hyman's question is a great question, because had it been remanded, then that means it's going back to the board for the board to do something other than follow this court's order, but maybe conduct further analysis, have a second hearing, even call additional witnesses. But when a case is not remanded in the trial, in the this court simply gives an order back to the board or to the trial court, the only thing left for the board or the trial court is to follow this court's order, unless that order is appealed to the Illinois Supreme Court. We all agree this case was not appealed to the Illinois Supreme Court. So that's where I struggle with whether or not it becomes the law of the case. And I'm not saying that I disagree, that I agree with what the other panel did. I'm not saying I agree with it at all. I agree with you that there's further analysis there, but it seems like they conducted that analysis, and it doesn't matter whether whether I agree with their analysis, nobody appealed the decision. Mm-hmm. And our court entered a final order. So I want you to help us with all of that. And I think we're Justice Simon's probably giving you extra time here, because we want to do the right thing here.
Right. Well, wait a minute. Okay. So the MCFA panel said she gets duty disability, but they never mentioned 154A1. And then the board held another set of hearings about that duty disability. So did anybody complain at that point that the board had no authority to do that? But Mr. Klein, when you step up, I'm gonna ask you that question. I mean, did anybody say to the board when they started the second round of hearings, hey, wait a minute, you can't do this. This wasn't remanded to you. You have no authority to have another set of hearings. What are you doing here? I'm not seeing anything like that in the record either. So on the one hand, the board didn't appeal the MCFA decision. On the other hand, I'm not seeing, it may have happened, that the officer and her team appealed or objected to the board having a second round of hearings. So I think the board was not treating it like it was the law of the case. And if there was no objection to the board hearing that second round of hearings, then I'm not saying that Ms. Nelson was treating it as the law of the case. Now, maybe that's neither here nor there, but I'm seeing gaps in both of these and all of this process. And the critical factor for me is who was paying attention, if anybody was paying attention, when somebody paid attention to 154A1. Did that happen anytime before it was in the argument at the second trial court level and at the second appeal, which is the one that we have in front of us?
I could not agree more. It was not analyzed or reviewed until this second round, because again, the issue before the appellate court, as Justice Walker highlighted, the two sites that they cite to when they're reviewing what they're looking at are whether she's entitled to an ordinary disability benefit or she's entitled to a duty disability benefit. So their analysis is under that, solely under that. Is she entitled to one or the other? Once there was a determination that she's entitled to a duty disability benefit, there is that second layer of analysis, which the appellate court could not have considered at that time because it was never before them. I would point out paragraph 35 of their order when they start, and they just say, Ms. Nelson's primary argument on appeal is that the board's finding that she is not disabled because of an injury that occurred in the performance of an active duty was against the manifest weight of the evidence, period. That analysis is just whether or not she's entitled to duty or ordinary. Once the appellate court determined that she is entitled to duty, that additional step, which I think Justice Walker recognizes, needed to occur as far as what level is she entitled to under 154. I think he has some concerns, which I understand, that the appellate court seems like they discussed some of that in their analysis of whether or not she's entitled to ordinary or duty, but they really didn't because it wasn't before them. And so that second layer of analysis was required because the board didn't make that finding either. There's nothing in the record about, in the original record, about the board's findings with respect to whether or not that pre-existing condition, how it was analyzed under that second prong of 154A1, because they were still trying to determine whether or not she was disabled because of an injury occurred in the performance of an active duty. They ultimately originally decided she wasn't, and they awarded her an ordinary. But then once that was overturned and there was a conclusion that she is entitled to a duty disability, you still had to go through that as a fiduciary under the law. They still had to go through that second analysis about what she was entitled to under 154, specifically under A1. And when I think you look at that analysis under A1, particularly the Samuels case, which I know we didn't focus on and I recognize why, but when you do that analysis, there is sufficient evidence in the record to support the board's conclusion on that second round that Ms. Nelson was entitled to a duty disability benefit at 50% of her salary.
But isn't whether there's a citation specifically to A1 or not, and apparently there was not, okay? We've agreed to that. Putting that to aside, let's not look at the terms, let's look at the substance. And if you look at the substance, then there is an argument. I'm not saying whether I agree with it or not, but I'm asking you. But there is an argument that could be made that, as Justice Walker, law of the case, this case is over. And there was no jurisdiction for anything further because the MICVA panel decided that the issue, without mentioning A1, but decided it was not at 50% by implication of their ruling and by the fact that it wasn't remanded for further hearings. If they hadn't thought of that, then they would have remanded it. They wouldn't have said that this is the end of the line. What's your response to that?
It's... Yeah. My response is, and I apologize because I feel like I'm sounding a little bit like a broken record, but I do think that they did not detail whether she was entitled to a 50% or a 75% benefit, a duty disability benefit, because they didn't analyze that issue because it wasn't before them, because that's not the issue that was on appeal. Because otherwise, I think the other way to think about it is, she would never, you would never, if assuming someone was, I don't know when you would ever in an appellate court context then analyze that second prong of 154 if you've made a determination that the person is not entitled. If it's sort of like the argument is by making the distinction that she's entitled to a duty disability over an ordinary disability, which the appellate court was required to do because that's the issue that was on them in front of them on appeal. There's no requirement to do that second analysis because it's inherent in the analysis of whether or not she was disabled because of an injury that occurred in the performance of an active duty. And that's not the case, because otherwise there would be no need to have that second subset or that second prong of 154. But the General Assembly put that second prong analysis in 154. So there is that extra element of analysis that's separate and apart from the analysis of whether or not Ms. Nelson was injured because of an injury that occurred in the performance of an active duty.
And I'd like to go on, leave this issue and go more to the merits. As I understand your argument, first, let me ask this. And to me, it's a yes or no question. And the question is, you agree that Officer Nelson, at least after the December 8th incident, had PTSD, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and that's what I expect you to say. Okay, so now here's the question, having a deep dive into the record, and I did not see anything prior to December 8th with regard to her mental situation, we'll call it. But before that incident, there was never a mention of PTSD, was there? No.
No. There was.
No. Okay. So the first time was after the incident. Now, there was some kind of mental issues raised by Dr. Dawkins, who luckily we have all through this case. So the same doctor, which is fortuitous that we have the same doctor having seen this individual for several years.
Yes, but Justice Hyman, Dr. Dawkins specifically said in 2017 that the PTSD was complicated by longstanding mental problems.
I'm getting there. So you would also agree that PTSD is only one of hundreds of mental disorders, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And as in the Samuels case, where you know, that case had to do with a back injury and a degenerative disc disease in the back. So there's a relationship there. Now here, PTSD is a different disorder than anything she had prior. Agree or not?
It's a separate diagnosis, but I would argue that the record supports a finding that the longstanding psychological issues complicated by longstanding mental problems.
But that's it. I mean, complicated. Sure, it's complicated, but it wasn't PTSD. There are hundreds, the DVM, you know, the medical record regarding mental disabilities and illnesses has hundreds of different things that people have. And you wouldn't say that it, because somebody has a back injury, that that's a pre-existing condition with regard to a knee injury? Is that a pre-existing condition with regard to losing an arm? I mean, it's a piece of physical piece of somebody's body. I mean, it That's my question. There is a difference. It seems to me what you're doing here, which is not in a very carefully worded reports by Dr. Dawkins. There's nothing that says that she had PTSD before. In fact, she goes out of her way to say how the difference is between what she, Officer Nelson, had before and what happened after. And it seems that you're just saying mental disorder is mental disorder. Is that your argument?
No, I would say that the record with Dr. Dawkins, some of which we cite in our brief, that Dr. Dawkins' conclusion is that that longstanding mental problems, the longstanding psychological issues, they were exasperated by that incident causing that disability. And under the Samuels analysis, which you cited, the resulted from in that second, that A1 analysis doesn't imply causation. It is the exasperation of a pre-existing condition.
But let's look at the exact words you're talking about. I'm looking at the conclusion of and recommendation of Dr. Dawkins on July 23rd, 2017. Here's what she said. Officer Nelson suffers from PTSD, which can be directly attributable to the duty events which occurred from the incident in December 2016. That seems to conflict with what you just said. She says directly attributable. Doesn't it say indirectly? Doesn't say anything about anything before that? This is her conclusion. The PTSD is complicated by, but that's like somebody having an injury to their back and then having an injury to their knee. It could complicate the back. So, I mean, there's a, again, it seems that we're talking about PTSD here, which we all agree, and she had other problems before that. And one, like pieces of the body is different than the other.
And I agree. I do think anytime we're talking about a mental condition, it's going to be a more difficult discussion than it is when we're talking about your back, right? It's easy to look at a report about your back and degenerative disc disease. I would note that if we get off of Dr. Dawkins for a second, the mental condition, and I fully recognize that the PTSD diagnosis for the first time occurred after the incident. But I would note that the mental condition, some of that longstanding psychological issues that were cited in the record did mirror the complaints that the applicant had in her PTSD, which ultimately led to her PTSD diagnosis. Feelings of isolation within the department, emotionally fragile states, things like that. So again, when we're looking at mental health, I do think we have to look at it differently than we do a back, which I agree, and that all mental health conditions are a little bit unique and nuanced, and I recognize that. But I think if you take what you're saying, sir, to its logical conclusion, then a mental health condition could never, unless it was a PTSD diagnosis made previously, which Samuel says, there doesn't have to be anything in the record before that. There just has to be a conclusion at the time of the injury that there was a pre-existing condition that exasperated that was exasperated by the on-duty injury to
cause. It doesn't use the word exasperated. The word exasperated is not in the statute.
Okay, what he did say was that longstanding physical issues exacerbated by the events in 2016. He also said complicated by longstanding mental problems. So yes, he said, yeah, she has PTSD, but he also referred specifically to ongoing mental health issues that she had had. So this fits exactly with the language of 154A1. Pre-existing condition that is exacerbated by a condition that already exists. And, I don't know, see how we get around that.
And I apologize, I was using the exasperation in the context of the Samuels analysis, Your Honor.
I'm looking at the statute.
To apply. Yeah, understand.
Yep. Okay, any other questions? Okay, hearing none, thank you. You'll have your
rebuttal.
Thank you.
appellees.
Mr. Klein, unmute yourself. Mr. Klein,
unmute yourself.
Thank you.
As far as some of the issues that were just raised, I know Justice Pazinski, about the how we responded when the board, after the Justice Mikva decision, that the board brought up this new issue that they believe is new. My response was a petition for review. As far as specifically referring to the Mikva decision, I thought that would be delicate because it was unpublished. So that was my thinking at the time. I thought the right response was the petition to review the board's decision.
Well, you do understand, Mr. Klein, that under Rule 23, even the old version of Rule 23, you can always cite a decision, which is the law in the case, or and there's other reasons you can cite a decision also, double jeopardy and so forth.
And that's true. I reviewed the case pretty carefully, and I thought the judge's, Judge Justice Mikva's decision, as far as specifically on this issue, so and basically I would agree with the board that because it didn't specifically refer to it, I thought I should respond with the petition. I certainly also would point out, and I think it was addressed, that in the first case before Justice Mikva, the board made very similar arguments as they made in this case. They tried to state, or they, you know, they their facts and their argument was that events prior to the December 26th injury were significant. And that was basically the same argument they're making here. So that's, I think, undisputed as far as the arguments they made in the first case were certainly the same in this case. As far as the Samuels case, I think a very critical difference regarding, and I think Justice Hyman referred to that, that not only was it one case, in our case, it's mental issues, that case was a physical injury, but it also in that case, the key issue is degenerative. And as far as degenerative is a deterioration, and certainly would continue up to the date of a new event or a new injury to the same body part. In our case, there's nothing at all that shows any kind of continuation. I think it's very clear that the last treatment that Officer Nelson had prior to the December 26th injury was in 2014. And in that case, Dr. Michelson stated in May of 2014, 2.5 years before this injury, and she was the last medical person to diagnose. There was nothing after May of 2014. And in that case, her report says there were no indications of current psychological distress. And as far as the only, the report of Dr. Dawkins was 2 years before that. So as far as, and even so as far as whatever Dr. Dawkins said in 2012, I think Dr. Michelson's report would certainly be more significant because it was 2 years later. Dr. Dawkins' report in 2012 was the last report she did prior to the December 26th injury. Her next report is 2027, about 6 months after the key injury. And there she first time has been addressed, was the first time that PTSD came up. As far as the statute, I think a couple of things are significant, and also the de novo issue. But as far as what the code says, an active police officer who became disabled on or after the effective date as a result of injury deserves 75%. And as far as any type of pre-existing condition, I think basically would be trumped by this language that says being disabled on or about the effective date, and there's no medical report at any time since Michelson 2014, it's hard to make a conclusion.
Let me give a hypothetical to try to get to your point. Police officer served as in the military and has PTSD as a result of that service. And then in the December 8th incident occurs, PTSD. You're the board. 75 or 50?
I would say 75 because the prior condition that you described in the military, if there's nothing in between, as far as there's an event, without going into the exact number of years, but if there's no type of PTSD within 3 years of this injury, I would say those facts would still support the 75% because this, and that would be
our case. Is there a case you rely on?
No, it just would be the issue about continuous. I think that's the key. And there, as far as the pre-existing issue, I think that's significant. And I think this goes to the de novo issue as far as interpreting the language, a mental disorder, which existed at the time the injury was sustained. And the board is saying it's pre-existing, even though there was no diagnosis since Dr. Michelson's diagnosis in 2014.
Right, so but Mr. Klein, we can't ignore Dr. Dawkins' final report. If you want to get to the merits, let's do that. In her final evaluation, which was conducted on November 9, 2017, Dr. Dawkins determined that Officer Nelson was still unfit for duty and had long-standing, and Justice Paczynski read this earlier, long-standing psychological issues that were exacerbated by the incident of the December 8, 2016. So the point being is that it's not this single incident that all of a sudden now the injury occurs and therefore it's an on-duty injury. It brings us back to the part I, which says that if a disability resulted from any physical defect or mental disorder or any disease which existed at the time the injury was sustained, then she's only entitled to 50% duty. 50% total disability. And that's exactly what Ms. Beckman is arguing. And I think this flies right into her argument. And the case is solid for her if we were to look at Dr. Dawkins' final report.
A couple of comments, Justice, would be one, with Dr. Dawkins, with all due respect to her, it's a conclusion. And I would state that Her prior report was 2012. Her last report.
Mr. Klein, are you now saying that we shouldn't be relying on Dr. Dawkins because she seems to be the star here for your case? Is that what you're saying? That you're discrediting her?
Well, I would just, when she's referring to past medical mental issues, I mean, I think it's consistent. She says she has a direct diagnosis, a specific diagnosis that PTSD did not occur until after. As far as I would agree with her that there was prior mental illness. So what I would disagree would be the significance of the prior mental illness. If there's nothing, no type of mental diagnosis since 2014, and what supports that is the attendance records of the police department that Officer Nelson did not miss any work for a 3-year period prior to the December 26th diagnosis for anything relating to any type of mental issue. So that supports, and the fact the last diagnosis prior to the December 26th injury was a report by Dr. Michelson, and it says she's fit for duty. So that was 2 years after Dr. Dawkins' 2012 report.
Well, wait, Dr. Dawkins singled out emotional outbursts on duty. So she, was obviously at work when that was happening. Dr. Bricker in 2012 said she was emotionally fragile. You know, there, so you can go to work and be emotionally fragile. She was, Dr. Michelson said she had anxiety disorder. That was in 2014. You know, so, yeah, there's a history of actual people who are trained to recognize these things, putting names on them. So you can't say there were no names on them. There were names on them. And they did. Oh, obviously they're called as witnesses or called as evaluators to give their opinions, their conclusions. So saying, well, we can't pay attention to Dr. Dawkins because it's a conclusion. Well, this is what she was hired to do, give a conclusion.
Just responding to that, as far as what Dr. Dawkins said in 2012, I think would be less significant or have less weight than Dr. Michelson is saying in 2014. So Dr. Michelson's report is 2 years after Dr. Dawkins, and she says—
After Dr. Bricker.
What I just brought your attention to is what Dr. Dawkins said in 2017.
Right.
So you're discrediting what she said in 2012, and you're going to now look to what Dr. Michelson said in 2014, but I'm pointing to what Dr. Dawkins said in 2017. Dr. Dawkins, in this case, was almost equivalent to a primary care physician. She spent more time with her than anyone of all the doctors. In fact, Dr. Hirst is discredited by the prior decision of the appellate court because he only saw her one time. Dr. Dawkins saw her more often than anyone. And I'm looking to what Dr. Dawkins said in 2017. So the merits of this case, I think there's trouble for you.
Well, responding to that, Dr. Dawkins says in 2017 that the first time PTSD was diagnosed was after the December 26th injury. As far as what Dr. Dawkins also says, that there were prior mental issues, that's not disputed. It's just the prior anything significant as far as that Dr. Dawkins report in 2012, I think would have less weight than a report. Dr. Dawkins saw Officer Nelson a week or two or a month or two or 6 months before the injury of December 2016, then the pre-existing argument would have a little Clark, more merit.
All of these things that we're discussing right now, these are factual issues, which the board has decided. And as Ms. Bakeman said early on, we do give deference to the board's decision on these factual issues. So if the board has already ruled on these issues, and the question becomes for this court is whether or not there's evidence in the record to support the board's decision. If there's evidence in the record to support the board's decision, we should be affirming the board. I realize that the trial court reversed the board, but for a different reason. Not because the trial court necessarily found that the board's decision was against the manifest weight of the evidence. The trial court reversed the board because the trial court believed that the appellate court in the first decision, the MICMA decision that you refer to it as, had already decided that issue. But now you're arguing, we're at the merits now. So we're not dealing with the legal issue of whether or not that first panel decided the issue or whether or not that's the law of the case. As we go to the merits of the case, we get to a point where, well, is there evidence in the record to support the board's decision? Certainly what Dr. Dawkins said supports the board's decision to some extent. Certainly what Dr. Hirst said supports the board's decision to some extent. There's clearly evidence in the record to support the board's decision. So you can respond to that. Now listen.
Yes. Well, first, I think you're describing the manifest weight issue. And I would argue that there's also a strong evidence for de novo because it's really
right.
Interpreting.
None of you have argued, I don't mean to cut you off, because I'm not a rude person at all, but none of you have argued what the true standard would be. When you're reviewing the decision of an administrative agency, such as the board, if there is a mixed question of both fact and law, then it's a clearly erroneous standard of review. And neither one of you, neither side has addressed that or even recognized that there's another standard of review out there. That's why I started with that issue, because I thought someone would have done some research and realized that there's another standard. And that standard is whether or not the decision is clearly erroneous.
But I did, and our brief talked about the mixed standard, but as far as I think it's, to me, it's as far as interpreting the statute, the key issue is ambiguity. And I think, so the basis for a de novo review is our view about pre-existing is that if it's 3 years prior, it's not pre-existing. The board's issue of pre-existing is that even though the last diagnosis was 3 years early, earlier, that could be pre-existing. And I was saying that when they keep citing Samuels as their key case, there's it's clearly pre-existing in Samuels because you have a deterioration that goes up until the date of the new, as far as degenerative. And in our case, there's certainly nothing degenerative. If she's been working for she was working, she was able to work right before. There's no evidence of any type of mental issue. And in 2014, the last doctor that saw Officer Nelson says she's fit for duty. So as far as the manifest weight issue, I would say as far as all the significant evidence, I think the case law that that they support as far as the Goodman case, I think what's significant regarding the manifest weight issue, if the court decides that it's not de novo, but I think I indicated why we believe it is de novo. But as far as the manifest weight issue, I think what's critical is that unlike the Samuels case, which the board relied on, in our case, there's no evidence of degenerative condition. So that would certainly contribute to the manifest weight issue. In fact, the only evidence would show the opposite of degeneration, because what Dr. Dawkins said in 22 is different. Dr. Dawkins says in 2012 that Officer Nelson is unfit. And in 2014, Dr. Michelson says she is fit. So that would show the opposite of deterioration. And as far as the manifest weight, it's clear that she was not working for 3 years prior to the injury. So as far as basically we believe, and I think the facts show that there is no credible evidence that shows a pre-existing condition.
You may be out of time.
Any other, Mr. Simon? Any other questions?
Oh, I just want to point out that I'm not entirely sure I agree with Mr. Klein. In 2012, Dr. Bricker said she was unfit for duty because she was emotionally fragile. And she requested relief from duty because she was overwhelmed by her duties. Then you go to 2014, Dr. Michelson, he says she has anxiety disorder, too affected to maintain safe precautions. Then finally, you get to after the event, Dr. Dawkins in 2016 says she's unfit for duty, she's emotionally overwhelmed, she has emotional outbursts on duty multiple times. 2017, Dr. Dawkins says she had PTSD complicated by longstanding mental problems. 2017, Dr. Dawkins says longstanding psychiatric issues exacerbated by event in 2016. I think that is a long record.
Well, it's long. I'm not disputing that, but it's not recent. I mean, Dr. Dawkins, the last time she saw Officer Nelson was 2012. The injury the key injury here is 2016. That's four years later.
She was seen in 2014 by Dr. Michelson. That's 2 years before.
And Michelson, I think it's pretty clear, says that Officer Nelson is fit for duty. So that's the last record fit for duty. So I think that as far as prior medical treatment, would be insignificant compared to the last medical report that says fit for duty. And that's 2 years, more than 2 years.
Mr. Klein, Dr. Michelson also said she was fit for duty, but she's being treated for anxiety disorder by her personal physician. So she was taking something for it.
Yeah, I do not dispute that, Justice. I do not dispute what you described as far as part of Dr. Michelson's report, but I just believe the key part of that report says fit for duty.
If there aren't any other questions, your co-counsel, you're going to split the argument, but is there any, what is the issue your co-counsel is going to address that we haven't addressed?
Well, I'm not sure exactly, but I think I'd like to at least give her an opportunity.
The same issue, so.
Unmute yourself, Ms. Donald.
All right.
Unmute yourself.
Oh, okay.
Unmute, thank you.
Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having us here today. We appreciate you. And I just wanted to say that my co-counsel has answered many questions, but I think the significant thing we have to understand here is in that 15 years that Officer Nelson was dodging bullets and arrests and domestic cases and all kinds of cases, she went to work. None of these alleged prior existing anxiety disorder stopped her from going to work. The only thing that stopped her from going to work was an eye surgery and I believe an upset stomach for a couple of days. But nothing in the record indicates that she ever lost a day of work due to any psychological issues. And I think that's the message that we're trying to drive home here. The PTSD came after December 8th. PTSD and anxiety disorder are mutually exclusive, totally different disorders. Back to Dr. Dawkins, in her July 23rd, 2017 letter, she said that PTSD is complicated by longstanding mental issues. In that November letter, she says the PTSD is exacerbated by longstanding issues, meaning the PTSD stands on its own. The other issues come in later and exacerbate, but PTSD is that standing diagnosis after that December 8th, 2016 situation happened. She went to work. She dealt with her coworkers, whatever was going on at work. She didn't stop working. Since December 9th, 2016, Officer Kim Nelson has not been at work. Now, as to this issue that the appellate court, the opposing counsel brought, alleging that, well, this just, it should have been 50%, that there was this second prong. At the time that that opinion, April 24, 2020 was issued, there was 50% ordinary duty or 75% duty. Period. That's why they didn't remand it back to the trial court. They made a decision that it's 75%. And the board thereafter decided, no, we're not going to agree with the courts. We're going to do our own little finagling at this meeting, and we're going to give her 50%, even though the appellate court indicated that she should have duty pay, which at that time, and it's undisputed in the record, it's 50% for ordinary, 75% for duty. That was what the board was supposed to go back and do, pay her 75%. Instead, they brought this 50%, and here we are again. The appellate court was not silent. I believe they spoke very clearly about what they wanted for Kim Nelson, and that was that on duty, 75%. This honorable court stood tall for Kim Nelson just in April 24, 2020. All we're asking this court to do is enforce what the previous court decided, and that's 75%. She's not asking for 100, she's not asking for 50, she's not asking for 60, she's only asking for what the statute indicates she is entitled to. That's all she's doing, dodging those bullets, dodging that person that robbed that guy, and she ended up with that guy in her car, dodging robbers. That's all she's asking for. She's not begging, she's just asking. Yes, ma'am. And good afternoon.
Good afternoon. There's no evidence that she ever came in contact with the alleged robber.
She went into a very dangerous situation that wouldn't go into if she wasn't an officer.
Excuse me, Ms. Delco. There is evidence that the victim approached her car when she saw her car. Yes. And they went around looking for the offender. They didn't find him.
Yes.
But to imply that somehow she was in danger from this alleged robber, that I think would be unfair. Do you have anything to add that has not been said by your co-counsel?
I believe, if I may have a moment, Your Honor, I just would like to indicate that I think that ultimately I'd like to just state, and thank you for being so gracious, Your Honor, that nothing that happened after prior to December 8th kept Kim Nelson from working, Officer Nelson. She went to work. She worked doing her job every single day through whatever anxiety disorder she may have dealt with that had been resolved. She continued to work. It wasn't until that December 8th, 2016 issue that she has been out of work since then.
We acknowledge that she had an anxiety disorder, which is a defined mental health condition. It's in the manual. You acknowledge that she had different issues before 2016. So would it be reasonable then to have a conclusion that the events of 2016, during which she encountered only the victim and not the perpetrator, exacerbated her existing anxiety issues?
Well, Dr. Dawkins said that the PTSD was complicated by longstanding psychological. She also indicated that the PTSD was exacerbated by longstanding issues, but there was no PTSD until after December 8th, 2016.
Well, that may be, but the definition in 154A1 requires us to look at longstanding issues and then something happens and then it gets worse. That's basically what it says.
But the PTSD, I'm maybe missing is this. She didn't say that longstanding issues were exacerbated by PTSD. She was very careful, and the prior justice said it, very carefully worded this thing. She didn't say prior anxiety disorder or prior longstanding psychological incidences were exacerbated. She said PTSD in her July letter, 13, 2017, was complicated by longstanding issues, that the PTSD was exacerbated by longstanding issues.
Well, then couldn't we read that to mean that this doctor, Dr. Dawkins, who was really the last person to see her, except for Dr. Hirsch, who's the board person, thought that she already had PTSD and that it was complicated?
If she believed that she had already had it, it would have been documented, and it wasn't documented until, I believe, 2017. No way prior to 2017 was there any documentation of any PTSD. She was clear. She was clear. And so I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you so much for hearing my counsel and I. Officer Nelson is here again. Just for the 75% that the appellate court in April 24, 2020, ordered for her to have. All she's asking is that order be enforced, and it has not been enforced. And we're asking that this court enforce the order indicating that she was injured on duty, that PTSD was not prior to 2017, and that any other psychological issue exacerbated the PTSD, not the other way around. That's all we're asking the court to do. Thank you so much. God bless you, and God bless America.
Thank you very much. Ms. Bachman, you can proceed.
Thank you, sir. I just have three quick points because I think you've heard a lot today on this case. First, I wanted to respond to Justice Walker on the clearly erroneous standard. I would just note that the clearly erroneous standard is also very deferential to the board's findings. If you believe that there is a mixed question of law and fact, I think the Seventh Circuit even has a quote that says under the clearly erroneous standard, you have to find that the board's decision stinks like a 7 week or 7 day old dead fish or something gross like that. So I would just note very, very quickly that I do think under the clearly erroneous standard, There is a similar level of deference given to the board's findings in this case. Second, I want to address the jurisdiction issue, which I think is really the main one that we've been struggling here today. I don't want to repeat what I've said in the past, but I do just want to highlight a few things from the appellate court's 2020 opinion. That being that they specifically note that what they have jurisdiction over is the circuit court's final judgment and Ms. Nelson's timely notice of appeal. And then they refer to the fact that Ms. Nelson's appeal and the primary argument that she raises on appeal is that the board's finding that she is not disabled because of an injury that occurred in the performance of an active duty. And again, then they analyze that and confirm that she's entitled to a duty disability benefit, period. Again, I don't believe that they took that added step of the analysis of what that duty disability looks like under the statute, which is why the board had to hold a subsequent hearing, which was not, you know, objected to by opposing counsel. And in that subsequent hearing, they awarded a duty disability consistent with the appellate court order. And then under the analysis of the record before them, concluded that she was entitled to a 50% a benefit based on 50% of her salary, consistent with that second prong of the analysis. And then lastly, just on the merits, just very quickly, I would note that the Samuels case does emphasize the fact that the statute does not include language stating that even if an officer has a physical defect, mental disorder, or disease prior to the subsequent on-duty injury, the officer is entitled to a duty disability pension of 75% of salary if but for the on-duty injury, the disability would not exist. And I think that's kind of the point that we were just talking about with the PTSD. It's not a but-for analysis. So but for that injury that occurred in December of 2016, the PTSD, that's not the analysis that Samuel says that we have to go through. It's looking at the record and is there evidence in the record to support the board's conclusion that Ms. Nelson had longstanding psychological conditions, many of which are described the same way that they are in 2017 as they were back in 2014, longstanding isolation, feelings of isolation in the department, et cetera, whether or not that was exacerbated by that on-duty injury to cause the disability. And that's exactly what Dr. Dawkins concluded in her 2017 report.
I'd like to ask you to comment on paragraph 37 of the MICVA panel, where it says, conversely, a duty disability benefit is granted when, and I'll read it because I think it's very significant to this issue. An active policeman who becomes disabled on or after the effective date as a result of injury incurred on or after such date in the performance of an active duty has a right to receive duty disability for which he does not have a right to receive salary equal to 75% of his salary, as salary is defined in this article, at the time the disability is allowed. Right there in this opinion, contrary to what you may have stated, is that what is being talked about in this case, the MICVA decision, is 75% for a duty disability. And then you go down to the end and it says, for the reasons stated above, we set aside the board's decision in order that Ms. Nelson be awarded a duty disability benefit. So they didn't talk about, they talked about the 75%, and then they go into their reasoning and conclusion. So how do you reconcile that with what you just argued?
Because again, the paragraphs 39 through that last 53, all are dealing with whether or not Ms. Nelson experienced an injury that she experienced in the performance of an act of police duty to then qualify her for that duty disability benefit. Again, I think their analysis is limited to the act of duty, whether
no, or no, why, not. But then why, I had to interrupt you, but we've gone on so long. I want to get to the issue. The issue is, under your reasoning, they would never have put that paragraph in there.
But
they did, so we can't ignore that.
If you're right, then they never would have paragraph 37. And after paragraph 37 is when they make all this argument. So it replies back to paragraph 37, and because you say it comes, 39 comes afterwards and so forth. Their premises is paragraph 37. And then they go on. And don't forget, this is right after paragraph 34, which says Ms. Nelson's injury occurred in the performance of an act of duty. So, and then they quote the 75%. If you were right, they would have said something about 50% there.
But they never analyze whether or not, I mean, I don't believe.
Why would they?
Because there's never a discussion in any of this that an analysis under A1, and you're saying, well, they don't even ever have to get to A1 because they've just made the determination under the first paragraph of 154 that she's entitled to that. Again, all of the analysis is about whether or not the injury she experiences was in the performance of a police duty. They don't analyze whether or not that the prior mental condition exasperated her current condition. I mean, they don't do any of the Samuels.
But again, we've gone over the exasperated. That's not in the statute. So, you know, people have been thrown around this exasperated, but
the resulted from analysis in 5-154A1.
Well, it's different than exasperated. I just wanted.
Okay, sorry. I keep using that just because that's what the Samuels court uses when they talk about what it means to.
That doesn't mean anything.
Okay, fine.
You may conclude, please.
Those were the three points that I wanted to raise, Your Honor. Okay. Again, the clearly erroneous standard, great deference to the board, jurisdiction. Again, I think it's very clear. While they analyze some of the same issues that would be analyzed under a 154A1 context, they don't have that issue in front of them. It was not part of the board's original findings or the circuit court's original order affirming the board. So they didn't have jurisdiction over that issue. And again, they emphasize what Ms. Nelson raised on appeal. After that decision was made, there was, of course, a hearing before the board that was not objected to by anyone, where they determined that, yes, she's entitled to a duty disability, but then did that further analysis that's required under the statute. And then three, I obviously did cite the Samuels case, notwithstanding Your Honor's comments. So I apologize for that.
No, that's fine. You don't have to apologize. I want to thank the lawyers for your briefs. Excellent arguments. This is a 40-minute argument that went quite a bit over. So obviously we are engaged, and your arguments engaged us. So we will take that under consideration. Thank you very much, and everyone have a good afternoon. And to Ms. Bachman, good luck with you in the next few weeks.